It's great to see you all here, the people up in the gods. Hopefully you'll still be here by the time I'm finished. Today's service, and as mentioned by Gavin, is our anniversary service. That might be causing some head scratching among you because the church opened on the 14th of June. However, the pulpit wasn't available on the two nearest Sundays. So Gavin asked me, could I find an alternative date? So I picked today, the 24th of August. As it happens, it's my late mother's birthday today, and it's also the 10th anniversary of my mother-in-law's death. So if they have the webcam, wherever you are, you say hello to Madge and May. The title for the address was to have been St. Bartholomew's Day, but as a concession to Gavin, which I will call in at some stage, I agreed to use the title The Great Ejection. To confuse things a little bit further for you, if the address had been delivered in June when it was intended, the title would have been Bunhill Fields. Hopefully I can bring all three titles together into something coherent enough to be of interest to you. Also, today is the end of Heritage Week, so it'll sort of chimes with that a bit. You're really getting four for the price of one here. Some of you might remember an article I contributed to the Uskilt in 2014 called Bunhill Fields. In the unlikely event that you do, I hope you don't remember it too well, as I'm going to recycle an abridged version of the article as the first part of this address. The article was stimulated by some of the debates then in swing during the lead-up to the 2014 Scottish independence referendum. In the event that Scotland broke away from the United Kingdom, some people were expressing thoughts as to the necessity of a new national anthem for England and what that new anthem might be. My tuppence worth was this. If our neighbours in England should choose to have an English national anthem in place of, or in addition to, the anthem of the United Kingdom, the hymn Jerusalem will, I'm sure, be among the leading contenders for selection as England's national song. The words of the hymn were published in 1808 as a poem by William Blake and set to music by Hubert Parry in 1916. At first glance, the words appear to carry a strong patriotic sentiment, and indeed, the hymn is associated in many people's minds with the type of gatherings at which the assembled believed themselves to be the upholders of England's finest traditions. As we now only use the old hymn book once a month, that was in 2014, Jerusalem is one of the many old favourites which are not sung on Sunday with the frequency that they once were. When it received an outing on the first Sunday of October, it was sung and accompanied with an enthusiasm which may have caused some arch eyebrows among newcomers to the church. Had they just walked in on some old boys' reunion, reaffirming that at least one part of Dublin would remain forever England. In anticipation of questions from our visitors, some regular attendees seemed to be almost mentally preparing some humorous apologies. But the hymn has never been the exclusive property of any old club from any particular section of society. A very wide range of groups have obviously found their own meaning in Blake's words. Jerusalem has been sung over many years at a wide variety of different events and occasions. In addition to royal occasions and Conservative Party gatherings, the hymn has also been sung at Liberal Party conferences, and for a period it had an almost equal billing with the red flag at Labour Party conferences. So I would suggest, while a superficial reading of the words of the hymn would place it firmly in one tradition, a deeper consideration of the hymn's words and a brief reading of any biographical sketch of Blake would place it firmly in a totally different tradition. Born in London in 1757, Blake has been recognised as one of the great poets and painters of the Romantic Age. Although he cooled on his initial support for the American and French revolutions, he remained a strong supporter of the anti-slavery cause, and he maintained a friendly relationship with Thomas Paine. One of his biographers attributed Blake's political outlook to the influence of the dissenting religious tradition, which had its roots among the opponents of the monarchy in the English Civil War. that he is buried in Bunhill Fields should really end any argument as to which political tradition has the greatest claim to Blake's legacy and, as such, to the hymn Jerusalem. The Bunhill Fields is in the Shoreditch area of London and is something of a dissenter's mecca. It's tucked away in this area in the City of London can be found Wesley's Chapel and the Museum of Methodism, the Quaker Cemetery, which is now a garden, and the Bunhill Fields Burial Ground. The burial ground was in operation from 1665 to 1854 and is the final resting place for many of the well-known radicals and dissenters of that period. When the burial ground was given protected status in 2011, the Guardian newspaper noted that in the 19th century, when it had already become a place of pilgrimage for nonconformists and radical reformers, the poet Robert Southey called it the Campo Santo, the holy ground of the dissenters. Many of the people buried in the cemetery suffered a lifetime of persecution for their beliefs before coming to rest here. The article went on to note that left-wing pilgrims of many shades visit regularly to lay wreaths, including the Blake Society members, who come every August on the anniversary of the death of a man who wrote Songs of Innocence and the poem which became the hymn Jerusalem. After many previous postponements, I finally got to spend a few hours in the cemetery in 2014. Most of the graves and monuments are in railed-off sections of the graveyard and can only be visited by arrangement. But in an open section where pathways converge, there is a simple memorial to William Blake and his wife Catherine. Close by in the same section are memorials to the dissenters and authors Daniel Defoe, best known for Robinson Crusoe, and John Bunyan, author of A Pilgrim's Progress and of Who Would True Valour See, the hymn we opened with today. Nearby, inside one of the rail sections, is the grave of Reverend Isaac Watts, a dissenting minister known as the Father of Hymnody. Eight of his hymns appear in our old book and four in the new book, and one of them is our next hymn. The roll of names of those buried in Bunhill Fields amounts to something of a who's who of every shade and includes of the Protestant dissenters of every shade and includes the names of at least four ministers who occupied pulpits here in Dublin. Reverend John Owen, described as an intellectual and physical giant, was the very first minister of this congregation, and his portrait hangs downstairs in our vestry. Reverend Daniel Williams was called to Wood Street in 1667, where he remained as minister for 20 years. He donated a considerable sum to the congregation for the education of young people, the support of a preacher to the native Irish, that means Oscailge, and for the relief of the widows of poor ministers. He is better known, though, for the substantial donation of money and books he made towards the founding of the Dissenters' Library in London. Dr. Williams' Library, as it became known, has had many Unitarian links since its foundation, particularly with the Newington Green Church. The library is alive and well today and describes itself on its website as the preeminent research library of English Protestant nonconformity. Reverend Nathaniel Marr was one of an influential family of New England Puritan ministers. He succeeded his brother here in Dublin at New Row, and he remained as a minister in the city for 17 years before moving to London. And finally, Reverend Thomas Emlyn. Now, more biographical sketches of Thomas Emlyn have appeared in our publications than probably any other person who was ever associated with the Dublin churches. But again, but just very briefly, Emlyn was a minister in Wood Street from 1691, who in 1702 published a pamphlet, A Humble Inquiry into the Scriptural Account of Jesus Christ, which we all know ended up with him being jailed and fined, and he actually became the first minister to be known as a Unitarian minister. Interred as he is in such illustrious company, the question then which the Dublin members should really be asking regarding Blake's Jerusalem is not, why do we sing it? But rather, why don't we sing it more often? Also interred in Bunhill Fields are several members of Oliver Cromwell's family. Mentioning Cromwell's name in the same breath as radical dissenters can trigger varying degrees of emotion and disbelief here in Ireland, and I have noted at times a bit of unease in our own pews. I don't intend to mount a defence of Cromwell here today, but if the requirement arose, I think I could make a decent job of it. If I did put up a defence, though, I wouldn't be the first to do it from this pulpit. In 2010, we published What Do These Unitarians Believe? A collection of sermons by Reverend Saville Hicks, minister here for 52 years. In the foreword to the book, the late Reverend Bill Macmillan of Dunmurry, who had been a ministerial student under Saville Hicks, wrote, "From how many other clerics with students have been advised, dare to go on thinking and never be ashamed to say, in all reverence and honesty, I have changed my mind. I delight in the thought of an Englishman at the beginning of the 20th century telling an Irish audience that Oliver Cromwell had some merit. He daringly recommended Cromwell's advice. I beseech you, in the mercies of Christ, to think that you might be mistaken." From my mid-teens to my mid-20s, I was very involved in social politics and activities in groups that had deep connections with socialists in England. Over the course of many visits and exchanges and to reading books and pamphlets and singing songs, it became clear to me that whatever about Cromwell, there was certainly a very different view among English socialists of the movement that Cromwell was the head of. Contained within that movement were the early Democrats, men and women who wished to see an end to the absolute powers of monarchies in the state and of hierarchies in the churches. The more radical elements, the levellers, the diggers, the ranters, wished to see an end to monarchies and hierarchies altogether. One of my favourite quotes, which I remember picking up on at the time, and it pops up every again now and again in books about socialism in worldwide and in the UK, Colonel Thomas Rainsborough's contribution to the Putney debates. And he was making the argument for democracy. It was a limited democracy at the time, but democracy nonetheless. "For I really think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he. And therefore, truly, sir, I think it is clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first, by his own counsel, put himself under that government." Following the victory of the parliamentarians over the monarchy, clergy and administrators who supported Parliament were appointed to civil and church offices across England and here in Ireland. The first bunch of names that appear on our roll of ministers were among the appointees: John Owen, who I've already mentioned, Stephen Charnock, whose portrait is also in the vestry, Edward Baines, Thomas Harrison, who donated the silver that the church owns, and Samuel Winter and Samuel Mader. After Cromwell died in 1658, a period of political uncertainty and instability led to Charles II being offered the throne that was vacated when his father was executed. The restoration of the monarchy in 1660 was followed quickly by the restoration of a church hierarchy. Here in Dublin, a great service was held in St. Patrick's Cathedral on the 27th of January 1661, when 12 new bishops were appointed. An anthem composed for the occasion includes the verse, "Angels, look down and joy to see like that above a monarchy. Angels, look down and joy to see like that above a hierarchy." The Commonwealth had come to an end, and a purge of the republican forms of government from the restored established church commenced. The following year, an act of uniformity was introduced. All church ministers were given until the 24th of August 1662 to conform to the act. Those who dissented and refused to conform were to be ejected from their positions and livelihoods. The 24th of August was and is St. Bartholomew's Day. Historical significance of the date wasn't lost on the dissenters. Exactly 90 years earlier, on the 24th of August 1572, thousands of Protestants were slaughtered in France. The memory of St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France was hardwired into Protestant minds, particularly into the minds of those who believed, with very good reason, that the Stuart kings were secretly Catholics who wished to have an all-powerful monarchy like those in Catholic France and Spain. In their sermons and publications, Dissenters were quick to liken the events in France and the Great Ejection, deploying the term Black St. Bartholomew's Day to refer to the ejections. And it was used over and over again in the subsequent years. In 2009, we transferred the library we had downstairs in the vestry across to Trinity College. For some reason, about a dozen books were overlooked and they're still down there in the press. I have two of them here with me. The subject of both books is the Great Ejection. One was published in 1727, maybe an original, and likewise the other one was 1806, also maybe an original. Even if they aren't originals, the books are still older than this church. I just want to, one of them is a collection made by the one published in 1727, Edmund Calamy, and it's a collection of the farewell sermons preached on the 24th of August, 1662, by the ministers who had not conformed. Now, it's a collection from across England. We don't know what the sermons were here, but maybe someday we'll uncover them. In the preface, he said, most of the sermons contained in this collection were delivered on the 24th of August in the year 1662. On that day, the act requiring a perfect conformity to the Book of Common Prayer and to the rites and ceremonies of the church took place. The effect of which enactment was the silencing of nearly 2,500 ministers, the death of 3,000 nonconformists, and the ruin of 60,000 families. Such was the result of the restoration of Charles II of infamous memory. Most of the ministers in Dublin, in fact, I think all of them, the ministers in Dublin who had supported Parliament during the civil wars, refused to conform to the Act and were ejected from the positions they held in the cathedrals and parish churches. Many of their adherents left with them, and together they set up new congregations of dissenting Protestants in meeting houses at different locations around the city. Our ancestral congregations, Wood Street, New Row and Cook Street, all came into existence shortly after the Great Ejection. Conventional Irish history is inclined to lay things out in lists of goodies and baddies. And top of the goodies, of course, are the United Irishmen. And no doubt top of the baddies, or somewhere near to it, are the Cromwellians. No one ever seems to notice about the religious descendants of the baddies, or Unitarians, or the people who have the greatest claim to be their descendants, are Unitarians and Quakers. Hardly people we should be all fearing. In his book, A Deeper Silence, The Hidden Origins of the United Irishman, Dr. A.T.Q. Stewart traces the tree of the United Irish radicalism back to a previously ignored source. Ministers of Grace is the title of a chapter in the book that is devoted to the lineage of the ministers of the Wood Street congregation, the grandparent to this congregation. It opens. Some special quality attaches to the Dublin ministers, setting them apart from the rest of the Presbyterian body, yet connecting them to obscure dissenting congregations in the English Fenlands, to Rotterdam and Leyden, and to Roxbury and Boston and Massachusetts. What this quality is precisely is not at first easy to identify, since there are several strands to it, and they have been the subject of little or no research. The essential clue does not present itself in conventional summaries, and it is not too difficult to be led on false trails. But once it is found, most of the other parts of the jigsaw fall into place. It is exemplified in the history of the Wood Street congregation. We are proud and fond, and rightly proud, of pointing to our United Irish connections around the building. The Emmet marriage certificate, the baptismal register, and other items around in our records that connect us to Robert Holmes, the Emmett family, Archibald Hamilton Roane, William Drennan, the radicals of the 1798 period. Supposedly, if you accept conventional Irish history, these people are the polar opposites of the Cromwellians. But we should remember, these radicals of 1798 took their seats on Sunday in the Protestant dissenting meeting houses and Strand Street and Eustace Street, both buildings paid for by funds left by a former captain in Cromwell's army. They are likely to have taken communion served on the silver left by a chaplain to the Cromwellian administration in Dublin Castle. And they probably borrowed books like this one and writings of all dissenting ministers from the Meeting House Library. If we join the dots, it's not a huge leap of imagination to suggest that they took a lot of their inspiration and principles from the same sources. We really shouldn't exalt one group and ignore another. When closing off the book, Calamy's book, although we do not expect another Bartholomew's Day or fresh edicts of prescription and banishment, let us remember the days of our forefathers and study their principles. Our city walks are back again in September, and the one on the 7th of September will be around the parts of the city where people were ejected from and where they set up their new meeting houses. All welcome, as usual. Amen.